Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to this session on risk margins and the work of the Risk Capital Task Force. We've got four speakers this afternoon, and so we probably need to get a bit of a move along, but it's my pleasure to introduce the four members of the Task Force who are here this afternoon. Starting at this end, Paul Nuttall, Briellen Cummings, Trevor McMahon and Paul Ivory. There's a couple of other members of the task force, three other members who aren't here today, Rob Daly, Daniel Longdon and Stephen Holstein. But each of the four are going to stand up today and say a few words, and if we could perhaps keep questions to the end of the session. When we do have questions, standard rules apply. We are recording, so please state name before stating a question. So, over to Paul.
Thank you, Andrew. When I saw the schedule for this FS forum, and I saw project plan for 2008 down for this task force, I was worried that nobody would actually turn up, because I thought you'd just think we were talking about a timetable. But fortunately, we are talking about quite a bit more than that. We're talking about the margins that we feel that we need to hold on risk business from a capital perspective. First of all, a bit of an apology. The paper that we have written only went up on the website on Friday afternoon, so I imagine most, if not all of you, won't have had an opportunity to read that. But maybe one of the objectives of this session should be to encourage you to go and have a look at that if you haven't already done so. So the purpose of the session really is to outline the framework that we have come up with, to give you a feel for that, then to go through some simple examples to try and illustrate how it might work and discuss some of the key issues that we've got and seek your feedback either now or later on. One thing I should say is that when we looked at the current standards and looked at the risk margins in the capital adequacy and the solvency standard, we found it very difficult to find a trace back to how they relate to the overall risk margins in the CAPAD and solvency standard. We found a fair bit of discussion around the actual level, but we couldn't really trace it back to some of the fundamentals behind that. And that's what we tried to do in our exercise. So we were established over a year ago now, seems a long time, by the LISB, in fact, who asked, I think, LIWMPC to look at the capital that needs to be held on risk business. There's a general feeling that the level of capital that was held is on the high side. Economic capital models that insurance companies use show capital to be lower. So there's this question about, is there too much capital that's being held? So it's to look at the protection business capital and also to look at the annuities. We've almost exclusively looked at protection at the moment, and we've still got annuities to do. And the scope today is only on protection business. We split this work into two bits. One, looking at the margins on the CTV-MTV test that currently apply in the standards. And the other bit was looking at the actual mortality and morbidity margins in the standards. And we had an insight session looking at the MTV-CTV issue, which is a fairly complex issue, back in October. The purpose of this session really is to focus on the other bit, the risk margins, but I just thought I'd put one slide up on the MTV-CTV issue. You can't divorce the two anyway. And that session, we looked at various options. The task force actually came up with the conclusion that the preferred route, really, for the MTV-CTV issue is actually to work out a basis that would apply to a distressed sale. A company gets into trouble, how much should it hold in that distressed environment? But we also came to the conclusion it's actually very, very difficult to set a basis for that. The feedback we got from members was that their preference was for what we had as option two or option four in our paper. Option four was do nothing, i.e. just keep going with the current position. And option two was to say, have a test, the CTV and MTV test, but do it on a basis of no margins on things like open claims and IBNR. So you can assume that basically all your active lives go and that you only need to hold your bell for the remainder, Or another way of looking at that is that if a company gets into a distressed sales situation, it can discharge its liabilities based on the its best estimate liability on its IBNR and UPR and any value that it has on the remaining active lives that it's still got on its books. Oh, one important thing to mention on that is that we looked at the way that the standards currently apply and that they apply at an RPG level, and we felt that that was at too low a level, that we thought that this test, which is a stress test, should be applied at a category level within the stat fund, so splitting out par and non-par and applying it at that test. And that's actually quite an important recommendation, as we'll see when Trevor comes and talks about some of the examples. You should be aware that there's actually an IFSA task force looking at this issue as well. They believe that the capital requirements are too high, and they have really decided to look at the type of capital that can be used to back the capital requirements. As their position at the moment is to say, let the Institute task force look at what are the actual capital requirements, and they'll look at what assets can be used available to back that. At the moment, they're very restrictive. You can't use subordinated debt to back the DAC asset. Really, equity is the main source of funding. And the funding of that capital requirement is really quite different compared to other financial services organizations like banks. So it's now becoming inconsistent with international practice. So there's this sort of parallel stream of work that's taking place. Our starting point was really to say, well, the CAPAD requirements and solvency requirements require a 1 in 400 or a 1 in 200 year event in a one-year time period. And we wanted to take that and then say, okay, well, what does that mean and how do we use that to come up with X percent margin on mortality? That was the objective for us. And to do that, we came up with really a five-step framework that we used in order to set that, and really it's part of the framework that we would be proposing that companies use in order to set their margins. A lot of this is work very much based on the internal risks of that company, their internal assessments of those risks, rather than a prescribed basis. So first of all, it's a company trying to understand what are the material risks that they have got. And then setting the individual risk confidence levels, taking that 1 in 400 and working out what does that mean in terms of a 1 in X risk for each individual risk. Once that's been calculated, it's then converting that into an actual risk margin itself. So that means X percent on mortality assumption. Then looking at what base should that be applied upon and considering extreme shocks. Now, I've rushed through that very quickly, and Paul's going to take you through in a bit more detail about those five steps and how they work. So over to you, Paul.
Okay, thank you, Paul. The first part of the framework is to identify the mortality and morbidity risks. Morbidity risks vary with product type. It's however, the company can classify its risks into the broad categories of statistical fluctuation, trend risks, where other factors such as economic and environmental circumstances can create a trend on top of the best estimate assumptions, concentration risks, and particularly for group life, external shocks such as new diagnostic techniques, particularly for trauma business, and also estimation risks, and particularly those around the quality and credibility of the experience investigations. Second step is to set the individual risk confidence levels. First of all, it's necessary to determine the required level of capital sufficiency for each risk to generate the overall level of risk. And the key in this process is to allow for diversification. There's an example on the next slide showing the amount of sufficiency required to meet a 1 in 400 type of event. A variety of product mixes was considered as the number of uncorrelated products increases and the amount of required sufficiency decreases. And the table shows that a 4 to 5% level of sufficiency is broadly needed for each type of risk for solvency purposes, which is consistent with LPS 2.04. And you can see how the requirement varies from 3.3% for death only to 5.0% where risk traditional and annuities business is included. And the requirement for capital adequacy purposes is about 3%. Which is higher than the current standards 1% requirement. Over on the next slide, the third step is to quantify the individual risks, and these risks can be split into the misestimation of the mean, the trend uncertainty, and statistical fluctuation. And over in the paper which Paul mentioned before, it sets out a lot of the considerations I'm going into each of these elements. All of these ultimately require an amount of subjective assessment, including the impact of the statistical fluctuations. And the factors to be included include the size, nature and circumstances of the business, and the effectiveness of the risk control framework, and the estimated time frame for corrective action, including these, like any scope within contracts, to vary the terms and premiums. Over on the next slide, there's a summary of the margins shown there. And the margins for the trend uncertainty and mean uncertainty are for ongoing deviations, while the statistical fluctuation is only for a 1 year sort of statistical event. For the ease of calculation, the statistical one can be converted into an ongoing margin. For example, if a period of 3 years is used by the company to identify, reprice and implement a new premium scale, the statistical fluctuation can be divided by three to make them much more additive. And when those margins are added up, again, it's important to include the diversification. So up there, there's a range of margins for the various product groups. Over on this slide, the solvency follows similar principles to CAPAD, and the solvency margins at 85% of CAPAD margins have been used. Step four is to consider the base assumptions used and the best estimate assumptions have been proposed. And again, a discussion of this is in the paper. Step five is to consider extreme shock events. Currently, the international trend is to allow for pandemics, including Insolvency II in the UK. And the shocks chosen were 1.7 per mil for CAPAD and 1.0 per mil in solvency, and similar sorts of events on disability income, and the capital's based on the greater of the two. Yeah. Well, now I'm pass over to Trevor to take us through an example of Brielan, sorry.
Thanks, Paul. That basically concludes where we've gone through the paper. Trevor and I are now going to take the paper and apply it to some practical examples. Specifically, Paul took you through the process of setting the margins, and the margins that were proposed earlier are those for what we would regard as an ideal insurer. This is a very large insurer. They've done a recent experience investigation, which is very detailed, and they have a stable product and they have set up a stable sales strategy. So what would it look like if we applied it to a real insurer? The example I'm about to give you, I want to give you a health warning first to say that this is it's a theoretical practical application, if I can use that phrase. And so it's not necessarily representative of anything which you might come up with if you actually did it on your own portfolio. The company that I'm going to use is a medium-sized insurer. It's got risk-only business and it's statutory fund. It's recently changed its underwriting medical limits, and it's recently changed its underwriting questions, so not quite so stable. Oops, I'll just go back. The steps that we need to go through are taken slightly out of order, to consider the diversification and then to identify the mortality risks and quantify the margins identified. I'm just going to look at the mortality margin. Firstly, consider diversification. Well, based upon the numbers shown earlier, and for that fund which only has risk business, we're looking at the risk-only numbers. So the 3% for CAPAD probably still holds, but maybe for solvency we'd want to be looking at more of a 4% rather than the 5% proposed. So could be a bit higher margins there. To look at quantify the risk margins, as Paul said, there are sort of three elements to the margins. There's the misestimation of the mean, the trend uncertainty, and the stochastic volatility, which we need to allow for. To take those each in turn, firstly, the misestimation of the mean. We know this company conducts its own experience investigation, and it does that based upon 3 years of data or 150 claims. The numbers that we saw earlier were done for sort of a large insurer, which might have, say, 400 claims. The company also looks at what's happening in sort of international or sort of from reinsurance markets or from industry studies, but that match is an exact match for its own business, so it can only get a little bit of information from that. Based on that, we might say that it's got its 5% base risk, which everybody has, and then the company-specific risk might be another 5% on top of that to allow for the lower number of claims in its investigation and the fact that any means by which it's trying to improve that number of claims by looking at industry studies is imperfect due to the lack of comparability or the lack of exact replication between its products and the industry products that it's using to match with. The second item is the trend uncertainty. The trend uncertainty is probably the most subjective element in the process that we've put together. The trend uncertainty is not necessarily size dependent, so a large company is just as likely to be uncertain of how the trend is going as a small company. The difference is that a large company might be able to identify the trend more quickly due to the greater volumes of data. So that might impact how long you need to hold the risk margin for. This company knows it probably has some trend uncertainty because it knows it's changed its underwriting in several ways. So it might say, well, the 5% base, that's the standard for the industry, for a large insurer with nothing much going on, I might need to double that and hold another 5% for the specific issues that I myself have. The third item is the stochastic volatility. This company is a medium-sized insurer. It's got about 30,000 lives. The large insurer, which we saw the base is set for, is about 100,000 lives or 200,000 lives. The company reinsures everything over 250,000, whereas a large company might insure everything over 500,000. So basically it works, the smaller number of lives you have, the more the volatility, but also the lower your reinsurance limit, the less volatility. So the two measures counteract each other a bit, but the number of lives is going to win out far more than the small reduction in reinsurance. So to their 15% base, they're probably going to have to add another 15% for company-specific issues. All of that adds up to probably a 30% risk margin compared to the 15% base. The second item is how long they should hold it for. For a large insurer, we're probably looking at maybe 3 years, but for a medium-sized insurer, potentially they might have to hold it longer. You have to consider how long would it really take you to identify misestimation of mean or trend risks and adjust for them. And a smaller insurer is going to take longer to identify. I'll now hand over to Trevor.
Thank you. Okay, I'd like to run through just a couple of slides just to give you an idea of how it might impact on a typical reinsurer. So I use the word might with Eddie sitting there in the front. He might disagree, but I've just come up with the current and proposed margins for a typical reinsurer. A typical reinsurer may select. So starting with term assurance, I've got 20%, 25 and 40 for the current, so a weighted average of 23, and you'll see those will all reduce to 19%. And I think I've been pretty consistent on the current and proposed basis that I'm taking the lower end of the margins for both the current and the proposed. So not much change for term assurance. Looking further down for DI and GSE business, you can see that for a typical reinsurer, the margins probably will be much the same, 40% margins. For GSC, they'll increase 30 to 45, and for disabled life reserves or open claims reserves, pretty much the same as well. Again, these margins apply to IBNRs, to active life reserves, IBNRs, and disabled life reserves, so they're used for all sorts of reserves. And on the right-hand side, you can see for group insurance, there's been a bit of an increase. So for death, TPD and critical illness, not that you see much group CI, the margins have gone up by at least 5%. Probably the weighted average is around about 30, so we're increasing the margin from 22 to 30 for group. So let's see what happens to the capital. Okay, so on the left-hand side, I've got a reasonable mix of business for a typical reinsurer. You can see there's $195 million of excuse me, in-force annual premium, term assurance 100, 50, 30 and 15. And the final capital on the current basis, 169 million, compares with the proposed cap add on the new basis of 78. Now I need to go through the columns just to give you an idea of how I've come up with that. So I've got the margins for the current, so we'll work through the current side of the equation. So I've got the margins there, you might remember them from the previous slide. The CTV, that's just on the current CTV formula, so looking at the policy liability compared to the CTV and also allowing for margins on the IBNR and on the DLR. So that all builds up nicely. Most of the capital is in YRT term, as you'd imagine, and some capital spread across the other products. Moving to capital on the CAPAD liability basis, we don't need any capital for term assurance, so looking at the best estimate liability plus margins on your mortality, you actually come up with negative capital, so the CTV rules for term assurance. For the other three products, the CAPAD liability rules, so we take that column rather than the left-hand one. And then to get to the final capital column, we're taking the greater of each row. So taking the higher of the two columns, we come up with 169. There's nothing magic about that. There are quite a lot of margins on IBNR and DLRs. So I have assumed that there is quite a lot of IBNR spread across the products, and there is a considerable disabled life reserve spread across the two DI products. Looking at the right-hand side, again, I've copied across the margins. The main point here for the capital on the CTV is there's no margins on the IBNR and on the DLR, the disabled life reserves. We're saying that on the CTV basis, we're really just taking the best estimate liability. So what does that mean for the product? So we've got 52 for CTV for term assurance as opposed to 60. You see how it's dropped slightly. That's just a result of dropping the margin. And also cutting out the margin on the IBNR. Group life goes to zero. I guess you'd expect that because we're really comparing a policy liability with the CTV or UPR, and then there's no margins on IBNRs. So there's zero capital required for group. DI goes negative. Some reinsurers might have their DI business in loss recognition, so the policy liability would exceed the UPR. And when you take the margin off the DLR and IBNR, you actually get negative capital for the DI business. And on the group, GSC, similar story. So for that column, we come up with 31 as opposed to 101. The capital on the CAL basis, it's fairly similar, I guess, to the current basis. Is that right? Yes. So for term assurance, we've got a bigger negative. We've got minus 47 as opposed to minus 39. That's just the impact of the lower margins. For group life business, we've got higher margins, so you'd expect to come up with a higher CAL. DI, you've got the same margins. You've got 40 and 40 and 20 and 20 on the disabled life reserve, so we come up with the same number. and for GSC the margins have gone up, so we've got a higher number. So that leads to the 78. The third one, probably need to explain a little bit. What we're doing here is we're putting through a pandemic scenario. So on the lump sum, from Paul Ivory's presentation, you might remember it was 1.7 per mil. So we're putting through a shock event of 1.7 per mil on sum assured, adding that to the best estimate liability, comparing that to the policy liability to see if there's any strain there. And obviously for YRT term, there's no strain. The result of the shock event is less than the policy liability, so we actually come up with negative capital. For group, there is an impact. So for YRT term, it's the impact of the DAC that means that there's enough cushion there for it to survive the pandemic. For group business, there's no DAC. There's fairly thin profit margins, presumably, on group business, so the shock scenario does bite. So we've got 28 there. Oh, sorry, 55. Look at the wrong slide. We've got minus 22 for term. We've got 55 for group, so that does bite. And similarly on the DI and GSC, it bites as well. So what we've decided is that a pandemic would only impact on your lump sum business or your DI business, but not both. So you meant to sum the first two numbers, so the minus 22 and the 55, to get 33. If you compare that to the sum of the next two, the 29 and the 15, which is 44, the 44 exceeds the 33, so we take that. So we've got three numbers to play with, 31, 78 and 44, and 78 is the highest of the three amounts at the category level. So what we're suggesting is that the current capital of 169, which might apply for a typical reinsurer, would drop to 78 using our methodology. Well, we're nearly there, actually. So we've got some discussion points. We thought we'd spend a lot of time on the slides, but I think we've got through them pretty quickly, so we've got time for quite a lot of questions. I probably should have said, it might be obvious from the last slide, but the main drivers for capital are really the level of aggregation. Do you do it at a category level, or do you do it at the RPG level? And the margins on the disabled life reserves and IBNRs in the CTV, whether there's a margin or whether there's no margin. They seem to be the main drivers of, you know, the large volumes of capital. But anyway, we've got some discussion points.
Okay. Thanks, Tim. That was great getting through it fairly quickly, because I think we are going to have some good discussion. Unless I hear any objections. Eddie was first champing at the bit, so... If everybody could just stand up at the microphones, we are being recorded. Just state your name.
I actually did give some comments to Paul, but the pandemic one I'm the most bit surprised about, and about the way it's working, because the pandemic, I think to me it's tiny. Like, the pandemic's happened, it's not a pandemic which is going to stretch out over a long period of time, so I'm not really clear about subsidising the cost of the pandemic versus what the best estimate liability is, because the pandemic happens the next year, well, you're still going to have your best estimate liability at the end of the year. You need the cash to actually pay out all these pandemic claims. So I just don't really agree with the offsetting of the two from a capital point of view.
I'll try and answer that. The pandemic, the way it applies in here is it says you have the pandemic and it costs you whatever that is, and so what you need to hold is your best estimate liability plus that, the cost of the pandemic. So you can pay the pandemic, and then but all you're left behind after that is the best estimate liability. Now, people can argue whether the best estimate liability is sufficient after the pandemic's happened, but that's what we're proposing here.
I suppose I'll just kind of more for probably a liquidity issue, is that your best estimate liability is an illiquid asset, so to speak, yeah. But you've got to pay out the pandemic claims. And you need the capital to actually pay up the cash for those claims, because they're all going to happen over next year, if it happens.
I agree, there's liquidity, she said. You've got to find the cash, yeah. And we haven't talked about liquidity at this point.
The other question, surely, is the diversification question. Can you really take the maximum of the lapse risk, pandemic risk and other investment type risks? in extremis, I mean, in the 1 in 400 event when everything comes down around our heads, is it not all three together, or very likely all three together, or at least not a zero correlation between all three?
Oh, I can partly answer that. We're still adding on a resilience reserve, so we're only considering the amount of capital for risks, for insurance risk. There's obviously the investment component. So in a pandemic scenario, you might remember that APRA came up with a shock on your mortality, and then there was also shocks on your new business and shocks on your asset side. We'd still include the shocks on the asset side under the resilience reserve rather than under the insurance side. I'm not sure that I fully answer your question, but is there...
I think what we're saying basically is that we don't consider the pandemic. We consider the pandemic on its own to be a 1 in 400 risk. The pandemic plus the lapse is not, plus mass lapses is not a 1 in 400 risk. That's much higher because... bad lapses plus bad mortality plus bad everything else, that's basically your CAPAD liability. It's sort of the combination of events occurring together is in your CAPAD liability. The other ones are specific shocks, and only one of those is going wrong, basically, because if several things go wrong, then it's one in more than 1 in 400, or you're back looking just at the CAPAD margins.
Yeah, I agree with that. And just to add to that, in trying to set the pandemic margins, we've actually looked at what we think would be a 1 in 400 pandemic chance, which is impossible to quantify anyway, but that's what we based it off. So diversification only applies to the CAL column in that case.
I'm happy to take questions on any aspect of the discussion. Before we do other topics, has anybody else got any questions on sort of what's on the slide in front of us there? John?
I've got answering that. What we actually did was, first of all, we just came up with what we thought was a pandemic scenario, and that really said is actually mostly about mortality pandemic and DI. There's not much of a cost. Then we said, well, does it seem right to have just a stress test of a pandemic? There might be something out there that could really hit the DI book or the GFC book, but we don't know what it is. So as a proxy, we said, okay, well, we'll come up with something that has a similar type cost to a pandemic for the DI and GSC. So it's not really anything to do with the pandemic, the DI and GSC bit. It's actually just an external shock. We don't know what it'll be. But we've used pandemic as a proxy for the lump sum.
Okay. Other points that were on the discussion list there. Use of internal models. I think in the general insurance context, internal models have been really firing up, certainly in the banking environment. It's been a big topic of the last couple of years. Interested in anybody's thoughts on, in the life insurance context, use of internal models for capital purposes? Thank you, that's reassuring. I think that touched on an interesting point, which is APRA's role in all of this. Does anybody, perhaps one of the task force members, might like to give us any sort of insight on where this heads and what APRA's...
So the next steps really are, first of all, we're very keen to get feedback from you. So feedback on this and the paper. We then need to come up with a final proposal for LIWMPC, who, if they're happy with it, will pass it over to LISB. Sorry, not LISB, to APRA, formerly LISB. And so we're looking at the sort of second half of the year for that as a timeline. And somewhere in the middle of that, we have to come up with our annuity recommendations. One thing that will be interesting on this is that we haven't really talked about it much today, is that we've said that solvency really should follow the same principles as CAPAD. It's just a 1 in 200 rather than 1 in 400. And we've also tried to simplify it a bit by saying, well, then why don't we set the solvency margins as X percent of the CAPAD ones, and we've come up with 85, whether it's 80, 85, I don't know. But I think that makes it simpler. Now, APRA may not like that, I don't know. I think that they probably quite like the idea that the solvency basis is X percent or whatever. So that'll be an interesting discussion to see whether they're happy with what can be quite a different basis for different companies within the industry. And it will vary depending on their size and other factors. Any comments on that? I'm also interested, just to try and get your feedback, how you feel about grouping at a category rather than RPG level. If you're going back to Trevor's, if you can go back to Trevor's example. Andrew, can you just go back to actually doing this calculation at this level makes quite a big difference to doing it at a at an RPG level, and then summing it up. 205 it came up with.
So the 169 would have been 205 on the
bottom. So we've got currently 169. On the proposed cap ad, it would be 205 if we went across the rows and just aggregated at the RPG level rather than at the very total level, at the category level. So, yes, it does make quite an impact.
And our thinking there was that if you have the sort of the mass lapse scenario, that's going to hit the whole company and the whole stat fund. If you have a pandemic, that's going to hit the whole, again, the whole company. And RPGs don't really play a part in that. So the question was, if all the active lives left, well, if all the active lives left, what we would have left in on this basis is just the best estimate liability on the existing claims. I should stress that in the CAL column there, the cap ad, the base cap ad, which is really the thing, there's margins there on everything. So there are margins on the open claims and the IBNR there. It's only in the, when you do the CTV test that there aren't margins, that's what we're saying. So they should still need to hold margins on that business.
I guess one of the things I'm quite interested in is the size of the different companies in the industry and how much work's been done, I guess, taking into account the medium-sized type portfolios and what this will mean for people perhaps outside of, and probably a lot of people in this room, outside of the top, you know, half dozen companies that have quite significant portfolios. Did the task force to date give much thought to how that might work? Yeah, sure. The question was just, has the task force given much thought at this stage to what the smaller and medium-sized companies that don't have perhaps quite credible portfolios might do in terms of these models and parameters?
To go through the three types, misestimation of mean trend risk and the stochastic risk. The stochastic risk will obviously come purely from their own portfolio, and basically it's not that hard to model a 1 in 400 event, how much risk you need, extra risk you need to carry for that. The misestimation of the mean, we're imagining that most small companies particularly will actually be heavily relying upon industry or reinsurer studies. So for them, they'd be using sort of the base risk of 5% and then putting a margin on top of that, which will be a little bit subjective and will reflect the extent to which they believe their portfolio is not doesn't reflect all the characteristics of the industry or reinsurer portfolio. The trend risk is probably the most subjective and the most difficult as to how much you need to put in there. And I think that the problems there don't particularly differ for small companies to large companies. It's always going to be subjective, I think, and depends upon, and you'll need to have a good feel for your book and what's going on that could affect it and allow for it. We're not particularly suggesting that everybody needs to do extensive modelling. Our paper does, for many of these things, go down to small portfolio sizes. So I guess you could rely upon that to some extent. For the stochastic risk particularly.
Conscious of time, Bell's a couple of minutes behind us. Perhaps one last question, if anybody would like it. Last opportunity. I probably had one last one. We didn't really talk a lot about the grouping at category level and perhaps whether there are scenarios, maybe 1 in 400, maybe not, where for whatever reason there's an event that causes a lot of lapses, say, on your term book, but not on people's income protection books. To what extent Has the task force considered all of that in the grouping and the grouping at the category level?
Well, when we looked at the CTV MTV thing, we first of all looked at what's the likelihood of everybody leaving anyway, and you soon come to the conclusion that independently that's not going to happen. And then we came to the conclusion that really the only risk is that something has gone seriously wrong with the company, either in that stat fund or some other stat fund. And if that is the case, then basically I think the term book and the DI book would both be hit with people leaving, and you do get left with the open claims and some of that. We also conclude, even in that situation, you don't lose all your book. Maybe you lose 60-70% of it, but there's still a chunk that you get left behind with that has some value. Whether you get it or the acquirer gets it is debatable. If that was the case and the company decided to leave the group market and there was some, well, effectively there is some cross-funding going on there by mix of business, then effectively their capital requirements would go up. So there's benefits in this basis of having different mix of business in your stat fund in terms of sharing those capital requirements, or potentially could go up.
All right, it's pretty well time to wrap up. If I could just ask everybody to put their hands together in the usual way for the task force.